if we're going down the same aisle. It's not intentional, I swear.
With the plugs.
All right, I just want
to... It's all good.
Zoe, do you have an Instagram, a project coming up, some shows maybe?
Well, for right now, I'm working on music and I'm doing stuff. I don't have names yet.
How can we find you in the meantime?
You can find me on SoundCloud. My name is Zoli, Z-O-L-I. And I have a few songs that are on there right now that I'm featured on. So they're other people's projects. But soon, in like some time, there will be a lot of music on there. I can guarantee you that.
In the meantime, do you have like a Twitter or
Instagram?
Also
follow me on Instagram at Zoe, Z-O-E dot Lika, L-I-K-A. And there'll definitely be updates on there. My SoundCloud's linked there. I post cute pictures sometimes.
Follow me. Vincent?
Yeah. V is in Valentine, N is in Nice, P is in Portland, T is in Tom.
Bam. All right.
SoundCloud, same thing.
Did you forget an N?
I said N is in Nice.
He did say N is in Nice.
Dang, bro. Let's redo that.
It's like V. It's
V is in Valentine, N is in Nice, P is in Portland, R is in Robert. Oh, I missed the R. And T is in Tom.
It's okay. I messed up my name at the beginning. Yeah. You're fine.
I hope you alright, Laura, do you want some random people following you on Instagram?
Yeah, I would love some random internet stalkers. But maybe I'll stalk you back.
Maybe not in public.
Maybe only when I'm in the grocery store.
From a distance, they want to
I'm down with that. DMs. That happens a lot when you're on Tinder.
Oh, gosh.
You get a lot of followers that way.
Word?
Advice, yeah. They're creepy, but they stick around.
They get the likes. They probably give you likes.
Maybe like all of it.
My Instagram is I am Laura Shea. That's L-A-U-R-A-S-H-E-A. My Twitter handle is the same. I am Laura Shea. Say what?
What about your music?
Oh man, I've been out of the game for a little bit, but I'm on SoundCloud under the same handle.
Right on.
Yay.
All right, well then I would like to take this moment to thank our very vocal producer, St. James, today. our editor, Nadia Kilminko. I'd like to thank KB Radio for allowing us to do this program. And I thank you, the listener, for just being so gosh darn great. I'm Crumb the Villain, and you have a lovely day.
Thank you.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is also available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Board meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month, starting at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
You're listening to Voices for the Animals on your community radio, KBOO Portland.
The more compassion we have towards animals, the more compassion we're going to have towards other people.
If you can value them all, you really value yourself as well.
So even if you don't care about animals, the things we do that hurt animals end up hurting ourselves.
It's almost kind of a dominion type issue where we feel we need to control everything.
Dominion means stewardship, to take care of.
What would a cow think about satisfying our habit? The challenge lies with looking at suffering from the perspective of the person or individual suffering.
Welcome to Voices for the Animals. I'm Deb Stedman, your host, and my guest today is Dr. Laurel Neamy. Dr. Neamy has worked as a consultant for many countries, finding solutions to resource management problems that protect both animals and the environment, as well as human economic needs. She is probably best known, though, for her environmental journalism and has written scores of articles for National Geographic and other publications, in addition to authoring two books, Today, we'll be focusing on her seminal work entitled Animal Investigators, How the World's First Wildlife Forensics Lab is Solving Crimes and Saving Endangered Species. Welcome to the program, Dr. Nimi. We're so pleased to be talking with you today.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Oh, great. Well, last November, Oregon voters passed Measure 100, which banned the purchase or sale of any part or product derived from 12 endangered animal species. But as we all know, to be effective, the laws must be enforced and violators convicted. And that's where animal investigators entered the crime scene. So, Dr. Nimi, can you please give us a brief overview of your book and tell us what motivated you to write it?
Well, Animal Investigators is really like a CSI for wildlife, and I follow three true cases of wildlife crime from beginning to end, from the native use of an animal to the instigating of a crime and killing the animal to the criminal investigation and forensics that solved the crime or that helped prove the crime, and then also courtroom and other outcomes, be it community outcomes or what's happened to those animals. And I look at three main cases. One is regarding walrus poaching for their ivory tusks, and another in northwestern Alaska, and the second is trafficking of bear gallbladders and bear bile, and the third is Brazilian Amazon Indian feather art.
Yes, and I also understand from your book that one of the main reasons you wrote this, or that it was necessary to write this and for the forensics lab to be established and for wildlife officers to be out there, is that due to, I guess you'd say, low staffing of wildlife enforcement officers, there's a lot of profit to be made for very low risk amongst people who perpetrate these crimes against animals. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, well, wildlife trafficking, it's really big business. And, excuse me, it's estimated to be about anywhere from $10 to $20 billion a year and ranking maybe fourth or fifth largest black market crime in the world. And, of course, we don't really know how big it is because criminals aren't reporting their sales figures, but it's big and sort of behind drugs and drug trafficking and ahead of weapons trafficking. And it's big because it sort of hits the trifecta. The products like elephant ivory and rhino horn are just worth a lot of money. Ounce for ounce, it's worth more than cocaine or other types of narcotics. So, you know, you get high profits and a low risk of getting caught, because where this often happens is in remote places, vast wilderness areas, sort of starts the trend. And then, like any criminal adventure, products are moved across many boundaries and changes hands many times. And so there's the poaching part, which is the killing of the animal, and then there's also the trafficking part, which is the sale of it. And the issue is that even if the perpetrators are caught, then the fines or penalties that they get tend to be very low relative to the high value of the product that they've just illicitly, you know, sold. So there's not that much of a deterrent in that.
Yes, unfortunately, in many areas of life, I guess you'd say, the animals fall to the bottom of the totem pole in terms of priorities. Now, the people involved in perpetrating these crimes, we're not talking about mainly downtrodden folks living in underdeveloped countries who are just trying to feed their families. I understand that there is a link with wildlife trafficking to organized crime and even terrorism.
Yes, and it varies by the product that you're talking about, but especially for the high-value products, they tend to be very organized networks which move wildlife products like elephant ivory or rhino horn and often they're also involved in other types of trafficking. There's been links with human trafficking. There's a lot of links with drug trafficking, because really, you don't care what kind of product you move. You're just more interested in the profit. And a lot of times, wildlife ends up being more profitable because the risks tend to be lower and the penalties tend to be lower. And then the people who are involved in drug trafficking or wildlife trafficking can successfully move these products long distances across multiple boundaries. And so that's just by definition start speaking of organized networks. And there's organized networks both in the consuming country and also in the supplying country of where the animals are being killed. And so it's very complicated. The networks are very complicated. There's a lot of links to funding different militias, the LRA, the Lord's Resistance Army, and there's been a number of different organizations that have been involved from time to time. And again, the products can change. And authorities estimate that we're catching less than 10%, and some have said as low as 3 or 1% of the illicit products that are moving. And the scale is just huge. It's really mind-boggling how extensive it is. In fact, it reaches into the tiniest places. In Vermont, for example, a rhino horn was stolen from the university there, a black rhino horn, a couple months ago. And while we don't know for sure what has happened to it, it's highly likely that that has gone into the black market. There's been a number of museum heists in Europe as well. There's been rhino killed at orphanages in South Africa for their little nub of horns and to boost the price, because the less rhinos you have, the more, the higher the price of the horn. And so it's really been extensive. And complicating matters is the fact that the laws can be a little bit all over the place. You mentioned the law in Oregon, and as you know, the laws in the United States can vary from state to state regarding the sale of ivory, tiger bones, bear paws, a whole bunch of different products.
Not to mention country to country.
Right, yeah. And country to country. And while it's illegal, say, to sell elephant ivory across international boundaries, within a state, it depends. And so there have been a number of states that have passed laws to prevent the commercial sale of elephant ivory, rhino horn, and Oregon being one of them. But there are a lot of states that haven't passed that. And so then the question becomes, where was it purchased? And at what time was it purchased? Was it purchased before the law was?
Yes, and talk about complications, yeah.
So it can get very complicated very, very quickly. Even for something that feels as clear-cut as elephant ivory, it's not. And there's that legal trade often serves as a cover for illegal trade. And that therein lies the problem, is that often it's very confusing to tell that. And that's also where the forensics comes in regarding my book, Animal Investigation.
Yeah, well, I was going to ask you, in your book, which, by the way, reads a lot like a murder mystery, I loved it, you describe in detail what wildlife officers must do to make a case that can be prosecuted. Can you kind of walk us through the steps that they must take along the way to make a strong legal case against animal exploiters?
Well, the first thing is that if they're suspecting that a product that's being sold is illegal. So say, I'll just give you an example, because maybe that's the easiest way to walk through a case. Is one of the cases I talk about is Brazilian Amazon Indian feather art. And the case started because a shipment a box filled with, I think it was 28 headdresses and body costumes and earrings and that sort of thing, came across at the Dulles International Airport mail facility. And, you know, the box was like 3 feet long and a couple feet wide, and it was from Manaus in Brazil, which is like the heart of the Amazon. And from there, when it was, so that made the officer suspicious, and it was opened to see what was inside because it was labeled incorrectly. And when they looked inside, sure enough, it was labeled incorrectly, and you had all these feather art, you know, those big feather headdresses and whatnot. And the officer suspected that it came from parts of endangered species, but he couldn't prove it. And so for each item that one would suspect is illegal, you have to prove that it is in fact from a protected species. And so, say one headdress might have different parts from several different kinds of animals, maybe 10 different animals. It might have some teeth, it might have feathers, you know, it might have little body feathers from chicken, but also some eagle feathers, and it might have some scarlet macaw feathers, and so a lot of different kinds might be in one single piece. And so then you'd have to send it to the forensics lab and get it identified, get all the parts identified. And so for some of the parts, there is a way to tell, you know, there is something unique about that species and that part. And for other body parts, there might not be. And when there isn't, the forensic scientists have to figure out, is there a way to tell it? You know, is there some unique characteristics, unique only to that particular species? And so feathers are more, we're all familiar with feathers, so you can think, oh, well, you have, if you're out in the wild taking a walk, and if you're an ornithologist or a birder, and you see in your tree a red bird, you know, and you know from the shape and the song and the where it is that, oh, that's a cardinal. But if you have just a feather, you may not be able to tell where it's from. And to make matters more complex is, if you just think of birds, you know, birds will vary depending on whether they're male or female. The colors of the feathers will vary whether they're male or female. And also maybe the time of year, their plumage might change, whether they're juvenile or adult. And that's just in birds.
There are so many factors to consider, and we're going to talk a little bit more about the forensics process in just a minute, but right now we're just going to take a short break, so everyone please stay tuned. We're back, and you're listening to Voices for the Animals on KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. We've been speaking with environmental journalist Dr. Laurel Neamy about her book, Animal Investigators, which is a fascinating account of how crimes against animals are now being solved with innovative techniques. Dr. Neamy, you've given us a good picture of some of what's involved in terms of legwork that's done in the field by wildlife officers to investigate animal crimes. But can you share with us now about a fairly recent addition to crime-fighting arsenal, one that can make a real difference in the courtroom? I'm referring to, of course, the world's first and only wildlife forensics lab, which coincidentally is located right here in Oregon. Can you please talk about how this facility came to be and describe what goes on there?
Well, it's really it's still the only full-service wildlife forensics lab, meaning a forensics lab that's dedicated to wildlife. And by full-service, I mean, you know, it deals with everything from ballistics to chemistry to morphology and genetics and pathology. And so it's really been on the cutting edge of finding unique characteristics of parts of endangered species and protected species, because key to saying that there's a crime is being able to prove that a part or product that's being sold comes from a protected animal. And the problem is that some animals are protected and others are not. And so, you know, a feather from a turkey might not be protected, but one from an eagle is. And so the question is, when you have that part, can you prove what species it came from, and therefore can you prove that a crime was committed because it was a protected species?
And there's literally thousands of animal, bird, and reptile species. And I know that you mentioned in your book one of the problems at the lab is that they don't have a standard of comparison for, you know, all the thousands of possible animal crime victims.
Right. And so, like with a regular forensics lab, you know, that deals with one species, people. But for this lab, it deals with over 30,000 different plant and animal species. And so you can't prove that a characteristic is unique unless you have something to compare it to. So those are called standards and reference samples. And so you need to be able to prove that that the characteristic that you discover is a unique characteristic compared to all the other characteristics from similar types of species. So you take bile, which is secreted in your gallbladder, and it helps emulsify or break down fats. And bile is in all species that have gallbladders, which are most of them, have bile. And so how can you tell a bear's bile from other types of bile? And so it turns out there's three chemicals that have unique levels for bear. But discovering that involved a lot of trial and error. And then on top of that, you had to prove that no other species has those levels for those specific bear bile.
And I remember in your book that a lot of the confiscated gallbladders from black bears actually turned out to be from pigs, that the wildlife traffickers were cheating in a sense.
Correct. And so a lot of times traffickers will use the legal species to claim innocence, and whether or not, in that case, I included a case where the forensics proved the person innocent, even though, or not innocent, but not guilty. the person thought they were trafficking in bear gallbladders. It turned out they were not. And so the science is neutral, and that's key, is because the scientists that work at the lab in Oregon, they don't keep records, you know, they don't keep track of who's guilty and who's not, or what happens with their cases. They get a piece of evidence in, and then it goes to the appropriate division to figure out what that item is. And, you know, we were talking about feathers earlier, and I use feathers because we all know what a feather is. But imagine that some medicine comes in. You don't know what's in this medicine. You know, it's this powdered pill, you know, and how do you know what's in it? Could it be rhino horn ground up? Could it be bear bile? Could it be just, you know, flour? And so you end up having to figure out what might be in it. And you don't have those visual clues like you do with a feather or with a tooth. You know, if it's some hair that's woven, how do you know, like, where to even start? And so that's where this lab comes in. And they really play detective, and they use a lot of what's known about a species to start narrowing down what's known about what species are in a particular location or what its was purported to be, some lookalikes, all of that. And then they bring that to bear to start the investigation. And sometimes they're really surprised, and sometimes, you know, it goes very easily because all their guesses proved out right. But the science itself is neutral, and their job is just to figure out what is it.
So you have, I think it was 35 scientists using some very specialized equipment and some very surprising techniques. I got a kick out of reading about the bug room, where bones are cleaned by a certain kind of beetle, is it?
Yes, to really just clean off the evidence.
yeah, literally. So beyond these valuable CSI type investigative techniques, what other steps can be taken to reduce wildlife crime and trafficking?
Well, I think clarifying laws so that it's very hard for law enforcement to deal with wildlife trafficking when the laws are inconsistent for a species. So when there's a legal trade, inevitably there's so many cases where this happens, where there's a legal trade in a species part, and it feels like inevitably the illegal product gets mixed in there and is laundered in through the legal trade. So clarifying that. Another thing is that people don't really realize how big wildlife trafficking is, or how it involves not just the, you know, elephant ivory or rhino horn, but it can involve lizards, parrots, you know, so many different products, butterflies. And so to start being more aware of the things you see around you. And when you do start to see something, be it on the internet or in your local shop, you can start to ask questions about it. You know, the aquarium trade, a lot of animals in aquariums are illegally caught or destroying, you know, caught in manners in which they shouldn't be. It's really all around us. And another thing is sharing information. You know, sharing stories when you see them about the animals or about the trade, and writing your legislators.
Definitely,
A big issue is support for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and also for your state agency, Fish and Wildlife Service, because they're the ones that are on the front lines and dealing with this. So budget support or just moral support, rangers who are dealing with this in Africa and elsewhere. There's a lot of organizations that, like the Thin Green Line Foundation, that support rangers directly. There's another over and above Africa that, you know, for a brief $5, you know, a small $5 a month, you get to see what happens with your donation, and it buys things like boots and, you know, mosquito nets and really, really useful things that rangers need. And in addition to the monetary contribution, just knowing rangers feeling appreciated, they put their lives on the line, and so feeling appreciated helps a lot in them going to work every day.
That's important. And I believe some of this information is on your website, laurelneme.com. And it's, which is a real treasure trove of great information, talking about your book that you wrote for children, Orangutan Houdini, and all kinds of suggestions and other valuable information about how to preserve our most valuable wildlife. Do you want to talk just very briefly, we just have another minute, about what else we can expect to find on your website?
Well, I've tried to make it, you know, on the one hand, information about the books I've written, as well as all my articles that I've written for National Geographic, MongaBay.com, The Revelator, and also a podcast that I had done, which is a series of great interviews with wildlife scientists and policymakers about specific issues, you know, from the head of the Convention on International Trade and Endangered Species to a teenager in Ecuador who discovered a frog species. And so some great information there.
And I've listened to some of those, and they are very informative, very interesting.
Thank you.
Yeah, great. Well, it looks like we're just about out of time now. Dr. Nimi, thank you so much for being our guest on the program today and for all the important work you do as an animal advocate.
Well, thank you, and for all the work that you do, and thanks to your listeners.
Thanks a lot. This is Dab Stedman thanking all of you for listening today to Voices for the Animals. To hear a podcast of any of our programs, just go online to kboo.fm and click on Audio, then Programs. And please plan to tune in again on the fourth Monday of next month. Until then, remember that you too can be a voice for the animals. Portland.
And now the KBOO News at Noon for Monday, August 28, 2017. On this day, 54 years ago, Martin Luther King delivered his famous I Have a Dream speech from the steps of the Lincoln Memorial to over 250,000 civil rights supporters. Many consider the speech to be one of the defining moments of the civil rights movement. In local news, a newly released report compiled by the state of Oregon showed the state experienced a 6% increase in homelessness over the last year and a half. The federally mandated report also showed that Multnomah County had an almost 10% increase in the number of people living on the streets. The report pointed to high rents and low average wages as a prime culprit for the increase in homelessness. The state of